Hi, this is Bridget Lynn Dolgoff with the Urban Farm Project on BBS Radio. And we are so glad that you tuned in, if you tuned in. A couple of things to note this time period is that there's going to be a rare Venus transit in June 2012. And there's a lot of information about that from lots of different people on the internet. And also something I didn't note last time, but I do write a blog, and the blog covers a lot more stuff than I usually cover on the shows. And I write about a lot of different things that I have personal involvement with, energy work and shamanism and organics, biodynamics, farming. And that blog information is consciousnessofeconomics.blog.com. So blog.com and look up Consciousness of Economics. And the title of the blog is The Urban Farm Project, just like the radio show. Also, the next piece of information is the next show is going to be on location at the BEAT Inc., which is the Biodynamic Association of Northern California's annual spring meeting. Where we do preparations, where we're doing our annual 501 preparations that we make. And you can find more information about our meeting. Hopefully you'll turn on to it. And you can get more information about the Biodynamic Association of Northern California. It's short as BDANC. For their meetings and other things that they're doing. So anyway, I have a guest today, and hopefully all of you have looked at the bio. And if you haven't looked at his bio on the main page, his name is Gene Brager, and he is this amazing person that I just really had to have on my radio. So I'm going to say hi to Gene. Hopefully he's there. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Bridget.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me along today.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I always get nervous before the show, so I always calm down after a while. So anyway, what I wanted to talk to you was that I wanted to allow you some time to talk about your bio or your history so that we can tell everybody out there who's listening that about you and some of the pertinent life work that you have done. And then maybe we can have a conversation after that about some of the specifics of your life.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds fine.
Okay. Well, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm 70, and I was born in 42. And when I grew up, in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, mostly Oakland. And when I was a kid, I did a lot of hiking. We had in the Bay Area. There's a lot of things growing in the Bay Area. It's a very good growing area for trees and all kinds of branches, bushes, and stuff like that. And so I used to do a lot of hiking, and I kind of fell in love with nature at that time. And since that time, and until even now, I've done a lot of study of how to make things grow, farming, gardening. I've had my own business. I've promoted organic gardening 40 years ago when Rodale just took over from his father, the Organic Gardening and Farming magazine. I was a big fan at that time. And I've helped to develop two communities, large communities, one in West Virginia, where I was for 9 years, and then 1 year in Philo, California, and I helped on that for about 3 years. And these, the one in West Virginia had 350 people on it, and we were completely self-sufficient. We did everything from cutting the wood, make for the fires. We were wood-burning community. To bucking and felling our timber and building the buildings and raising all of our own food. We're a vegetarian community. So we did everything and learned a lot.
And, okay, do you want to continue on?
Sure.
Kind of till now?
Like.
Yeah, keep going.
So now I'm I'm retired from the work that I've done. I've sold artwork for the past 30 years, and I'm retired from that. I have my own business. And I do a lot of writing, and I read a lot. I have been apolitical for the last 40 years, but now I'm seeing our country's in a lot of danger, and I've become a little bit more involved in politics. But still, I have I do want to help create another farm community, because now we need it even more than we did when I was first beginning to study it with the veterans back in San Francisco during the hippie era. And one of the things I want to do, in addition to helping establish a farm community, is to establish a granary. I like that idea because, for one thing, the wheat that we get is no good. Wheat will go bad in 5 days unless the germ is taken out and vitamins are added back in. So anything that we get, there are a few companies, or a few businesses in town that make good, they grind their own wheat and make bread from it. But not much, not many. And I'd like to be involved in creating a granary where I bring in wheat and grind it and sell the flour and also make bread and perhaps a soup kitchen there. That's what I'd like to do now.
Yeah, I was watching a show at one point about the Edwardian period. And they basically took these people and they put them back like in Edwardian time. And so you had the people who worked basically underground, you know, doing all the food cooking. And one of the things that they said, why they thought that there was so much mental illness in hierarchy, was because when the people that were growing the food and then they also were making it, when they would cut the grain, because they had to work such hard hours, they would keep the grain, the part of the grain that had all the nutrient, and they would shuffle the rest of it, the nutrient depleted, to the hierarchy for their food. And they, and it was interesting because I thought it was a very interesting situation about not being able to get the health benefits of that, you know, broken grain like right away, but the B vitamin levels that are depleted as a result of not getting the nutrient-rich grain.
Uh-huh. One of the things that I've found out recently in that order is that the RNA, which is the building blocks of the DNA. We hear a lot of talk about DNA and how it makes the body what it is. But the RNA is the building blocks of the DNA, so it's even smaller yet. And recent science shows clearly that if we take in products that have, like bent or destroyed or RNA, that RNA goes into the DNA. We eat it, but it doesn't change the distorted RNA that's in the DNA. And so that distorted RNA comes and reconnects into the DNA in our body. So it puts a new spin on the old adage, we are what we eat.
Wow, that's a pretty amazing...
Yeah, it is. And it doesn't mean, and it hasn't been proved that, well, if you eat so much of this modified food or that modified oil that your right ear is going to be lower than your left ear, or you're going to have so much deformation in your body, that hasn't come about yet, that the direct correlation. But we can commonsensically understand that, gee, if we keep taking in products with modified RNA, that it's gonna reflect on our bodies down the line.
Yeah, no, it's pretty serious, like what's happening to our food supplies.
Uh-huh.
And it's great, you know, like people like you who have like all this really great experience, you know, through your lifetime, you know, still wanting to help, you know, create projects like greeneries and stuff like that. So, because, you know, your education and levels of information through your life experience are probably much better than a lot of us who are younger, you know, because we didn't really live through or move into the organic movement, you know. So I think it's great that you want to do greeneries, and I'm pretty excited about that.
I want to just speak a little bit more about some of the experiences I had helping build the farms, the communities. And that is that, again, I said we did everything. Buck and felled the timber. We plowed with oxen and horses. And we hauled things around the farm community with draft animals. And in West Virginia, we used to go into the Amish country and in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and buy at their auctions. They knew us pretty well. I was in a Hare Krishna community in West Virginia called New Vrindavan, close to Wheeling, between Wheeling and Moundsville. And so we were pretty good friends with the Amish because we used to buy a lot of their stuff when a farm would go out of business or when it would get older, we would be there to buy it because they kept very good care of their things. And then we'd bring it to our farm and use it from there. So we did literally everything. And if the team, and it's a matter of teamwork, if one member of the team didn't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and put on the wood, there would be no hot water. And if he didn't get up at 5 and start breakfast, at 6 or 7, there would be no breakfast. And so we really had to work like a team.
What were some of the most important highlights, do you think, of that time? That's a pretty important highlight if the person didn't get up in your community. That's a huge thing. But were there any other highlights living in a community or awarenesses that you may have picked up that you may not have gotten until that point in time? And also, too, when you look back, are there any awarenesses that you have now as a direct result of that experience?
Well, the most important thing was the relationship with our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. And that represented a sea change for me and for the other devotees there in the community. So that was by far the most important thing. But going from that, drawing from that, our spiritual master told us that farm communities are what's needed for the future. And in this way, by having communities like that, not being in a city, the city is in the mode of passion and ignorance. But in living in the country and being on a farm, being close to the land, taking care of the cow, raising vegetables and grains, is in the mode of goodness. And it's easier to find peace in one's heart and to develop a transcendental attitude, a perspective, by living in the farm, by living in the country. So that was the most important thing after the influence of our spiritual master and our spiritual philosophy. But looking back, as I said at the beginning when we started talking, it's clear that now it's even more important. And with the way the government is acting and our feeling around the world, the European economy is a train wreck that we can see. It's very, very clear what's going on in Europe for those who look over the news that's going on there. But the same thing, of course, is happening in the United States. But it's covered over here. We don't see it as clearly as we can see it in Europe. But the same thing is happening. So in retrospect, looking back, it's more important now to begin building more agrarian communities than it was then.
Yeah, I'm like in full agreement of that. One of the things that I want to tell our people listening in that we haven't talked about is that you were in the military.
Yes, I was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And, my son now is in the Marine Corps. I have a 22. My youngest boy is 22, and he's just getting out. He had he's been 4 years, and he did rather well. The rank, he's a corporal. He went in as, a private, and now he's a corporal, so he's a leader. And he's been three tours in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's
it. He'll be getting out this month after 4 years.
And your other son, there was something important that I got, was that you had a son that committed suicide, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Was there anything in particular do you think that he was struggling with at that time?
Yeah, well, he was going to a college at Santa Barbara, a junior college. And when he was with me, at that time, I was doing well financially. And we had a nice home. But then I began to not be doing as well. It was one of my down period a bit financially. When you're working for yourself, you face ups and downs a lot. And at that time, I wasn't doing quite as well as I wanted to, and I couldn't give him the money that I wanted, and he was used to having things pretty much taken care of. When I visited his apartment, it wasn't cheery and nice and, how to say, a lot of vitality like we had at home. And I suspect he's a sensitive kid, a very intelligent, sensitive kid, young man. He's 20 at the time. And then it's very difficult for young men. Young men between the ages of 20 and 25 have the highest suicide rates with young men. So it was a difficult time for him. And I miss him dearly.
I can imagine. I can't even, I can't imagine what it would be like.
We were good friends.
I believe that. I believe that without a shadow of a doubt. So during, when your son committed suicide, was there anything that changed you, that is helping
you?
Yeah,
I had a profound change. I'm a fairly stern fellow. I have a demeanor about me that's serious. I'm a grave fellow. I like to jokes and smile and laugh, but in general, I'm a grave person. One of the things that I learned when one tries to look at the flip side. They say that there's always the flip side where something bad happens. The flip side is there's something good on the other side. Well, it was pretty hard for me to find that when I lost my son. But over the years, it began to occur to me more and more, not that it ever has diminished the importance of losing him, but I learned to laugh a lot more. I learned to, because when something that serious happens, then everything else, the seriousness of it, it isn't as important. It isn't as important. You lose a son, and then everything else it diminishes. The argument with a neighbor or a bad traffic situation, these things lose their importance. And so, consequently, I began to laugh more at life when problems came along. So that was one of the big things. And then also to know, the biggest thing was that we have our philosophy says that if Krishna loves you, then he gives you a lot. But if he really loves you, then he takes everything away. The idea there is that ultimately we have to give up everything. And if we want to go back home, back to God, then we have to learn to serve God.
That's beautiful. I really like that a lot. So one of the other things, too, that I figured we get all that kind of stuff out of the background, but I know that you're a huge Ron Paul supporter right now.
Uh-huh.
And there are some, information that you've been coming across that quite a few of us probably have been as well. Some people not so much. Just about political stuff that's going on right now. And so one of the things that I really like that I was looking at. Also, too, I wanted to talk to you really quick about your methane digester. And then we'll go on to Ron Paul. But I think that's a pretty interesting thing. You know, not a lot of people have actually probably made one.
Uh-huh.
And they're always talking about methane is the cause because of all the cattle of the global warming. It's part of the cause. So could you talk a little bit on the methane digester?
Yeah, they're a little bit difficult to make, but nothing that we can't do. There's two different kinds. One is the batch method, and then which you put your waste in it, and then you kind of let it percolate. And you may add this or that as time goes on. And then all at once, when it's finished digesting, then you drain it out. And then you have in the meantime, you're making your methane. Then when you drain it out, then you have a slurry that's very, very good for the ground.
Oh, good.
In most instances, you do not use human waste. You can, but you have to be much more careful, and you can't. You have to use the digester, the slurry in a different way. You can't put it directly on crops. But if you use vegetable cuttings and cow manure, or from goats or horses, whatever, then you can put it very close to the crops. But still, normally one doesn't put it close to root crops, and you have to be careful with it. Still, human waste, there are a lot of pathogens, and that needs further exposure to the sun and to the weather. But with manure from cows, that problem isn't there. And this is science. This is not my opinion. Science. Then the other kind of digester is the continuous batch, where you have a tube. It has a certain ratio of the height of the tube, let us say 5 foot high by 8 foot long, and it's like at an angle. And then you continuously add waste to it, whether it be grass cuttings, vegetable stalks, and things like that are cut up, and then manure. It can be chicken manure, cow manure, whatever. And then the methane is produced continuously from that. And then you can pull off the slurry. And this is continuous batch method. So there you have the two. And generally the one where you make just one batch, you stop it, drain it, and then you start another batch, usually that's like a cylinder that's up and down. It can even be square, just like you have a barrel sitting upright. But with the continuous, you have to have, there are certain proportions between the height and the length, and you have that sitting at an angle on its side, and you take the slurry off the back, and then you put the waste in on the front, top side. So two kinds of digesters, generally.
Well, I hope in my future I'll be able to make one on my farm. When I get my farm, you'll have to come out and help me.
They're really not that hard to make. If you can start making them with cement pipes, or even plastic pipes, or small cylinders. And the continuous digester is the best one. Once
excellent.
You get them working, they're the easiest to work with.
Excellent, excellent. No, I was excited about that because it was something I really didn't know much about. So, another thing, too, I was looking through was that we were talking about an educated and informed populace. And and that you're, you know, you consider that our republic kind of depends upon that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the founding fathers did, and I've learned that from what I've read about how the founding fathers believed. And it's interesting. I was looking for a quote that I wrote in the in my talking points, but I can't find it right now. But it was by John Adams. And he said that we men and women, we citizens, have a tendency to, once the government is established, we just kind of let it go, let it roll on, and not take too much interest in it. We give over our interest to the people that are running it. And he said, and this was when the time the Constitution was written, he says, this is very dangerous, very dangerous. And personally, I've been apolitical ever since Kennedy was killed. That hurt me a lot when that happened. And I just was a little fed up and with politics, and I just kind of didn't think much of politicians, and I just kind of let them go with the idea in mind that we have a very strong nation, a wonderful constitution. And even if we get idiots running it, they're not going to hurt it that much. Well, that's a mistaken notion. It's very mistaken. And John Adams points that out. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, about the time Bush sent our troops into Iraq, well, it's been longer than that, actually. The second time after the Kuwaiti thing, but after he sent the troops in, I couldn't wrap my mind around why he would do such a stupid thing, is to send our troops into Iraq. And even if the worst case scenario, what they were saying was true, still we didn't need to send our troops there. So I began reading and studying at the time, and I began to take more of an interest in politics because I saw danger at that time, not understanding how our leaders can take us in harm's way like this. And one of the books, and I'd like to recommend this, that I read that really started me off on my journey, was a book by G.W. Griffin, and it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Creature from Jekyll Island. Now, Mr. Griffin is a very good writer. He writes science fiction, but he's also a wonderful scholar. And what he has done is he's explored the influence of the central banks on our country and all over the world. And he's written a really wonderful, easy-to-read narrative about how this has influenced our government, how it actually controls our government and the way things are run. And so for the past 6 or 7 years since I read that, I've become more and more interested in politics. And now I see, I'm alarmed by just how corrupt our government is in the financial system. And it's not a simple thing like the Occupy movement makes it out to be. It's not the rich. There's a difference between the rich. We Americans, that's okay. You can be rich. But then there's the corrupt. And we have now with us like a tidal wave of corruption and greed and self-serving in our politics and in our financial institutions, that it's overwhelming us. But anybody that's more interested to start learning, I would recommend, there are lots of nice, good websites. One can't learn anything really from watching the news. But if one starts with The Creature from Jekyll Island, then he'll or she'll begin to get a very good education on what's going on.
Yeah, that's a super good book, actually.
You're trailing off. I can't hear you so much.
Oops, sorry about that. My little microphone's been kind of cranky. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're a little soft, but I can still hear you.
So a couple other things, too, was that I just want to reiterate to people out there that, you know, you were a Marine, right? And
right.
And so, and you were talking a little bit about, like, you just kind of fell out of the political, philosophies, I guess, after Kennedy was assassinated. And so I would have been a really small kid, and I probably wouldn't have noticed something like that. But I have a feeling that it really has impacted, like, a really large generation of our society, and predominantly, like, the baby boomers.
I have seen that. I have seen evidence of that. I have seen men and women, now that I'm on the Ron Paul campaign organization I'm working with. I'm a delegate now. I'm going to the state convention here in 4 weeks. And I have seen men and women around my age write the similar things, that they just became less interested. But then the other thing is now is that Ron Paul is a man with such integrity. One may not agree with this policy, that policy, but he has such integrity, and he wants to put us back on the path, the constitutional path, that our forefathers outlined for us. And the present administration is taking this away. And the other candidates aren't saying anything about it. They don't even bring it up in their speeches, that we're drifting farther and farther away from the path of our Constitution.
Yeah,
whereas Ron Paul is addressing it precisely.
Yeah,
and he wants to bring
back. Just out of curiosity, I've talked to a lot of different people with a lot of speculation, you know, because all of it's speculative at this point. Like, if Ron Paul got in, what would happen? And a lot of people are kind of scared, like, you know, if he did get in, and they feel like he'd probably get assassinated, and, you know.
All of that is there. I had that same fear. Because the establishment hates him. They hate him. And, I had that fear. So one of the things we can see is that he has pretty much of a media blackout. The media doesn't hardly even talk about him. But yet, when Santorum or Romney, they have meetings with 200 or 300 people, that makes big news. But Ron Paul, just the other day in Wisconsin, had a meeting with 5,000 people, came out, didn't even make the papers. And this happens often. Yeah. I was at the meeting here in when he was here in Reno. I think it was 6 weeks ago. 6 weeks ago, about that. 5-6 weeks ago. And we had 2,000, I'd say 1,500 to 2,000 people there. And that's a hard estimate. It's a good estimate, because given the size of the meeting hall and the number of chairs that were there, the range in estimate was between 1,000 to 1,500 people. When Romney was here, he had about 350, and Gingrich had less than that. And they reported on Gingrich and Romney, and they reported that Ron Paul had 250 to 300 people. Showed up.
But, you know, the other thing, too, sometimes I think about, like, in this day and age, it's so easy to get, you know, news that has been blocked out for so long. I mean, and it just seems like this is kind of like, you know, just another showing of, you know, what really has been going on, kind of maybe by the establishment for a long time. Like, this is how they've been getting their, you know, their projected candidates in.
Yes.
A friend of mine who was murdered, And he told me about 2 years before he was murdered that anybody that the Bilderberger Group dines will be in office as a president no matter what. That's what he told me. Because he had seen it firsthand.
Okay.
And so like the Bilderberger Group, you know, they've been in control for such a long time, but we never really saw it because the internet wasn't really wasn't big in a lot of other election time periods. Now we have like whole networking sites where people can transfer information so rapidly, you know, across the world. And so
Jet are an integral part of that.
Yeah. So now maybe we're seeing like the level of corruption that's going on around Ron Paul, because before we didn't really have these networking sites that we could see it clearly. And so the internet is a really integral piece of, you know, freedom, really, and our right to free speech and our right to free religion and our rights to, tell the truth however we see it and express that to each other.
Yes, and this really upsets the establishment, and that's why they're making such big efforts with this SOPA, these two initiatives in our Congress, and then the one initiative which has already partially succeeded on the UN, of which Obama has recently signed on to restrict internet access more and more. So the establishment's very much aware that the internet is defeating, but certainly. It hasn't defeated it yet. It's not defeating it now, but certainly is a big competition to their organization and their control of the media. And so things aren't going as well for them as they like would have it go for them. And yeah, it's a big threat. It's a big threat. It's a revolution. This internet. And I have a good friend in Hawaii. He's my age, and he's not that I'm so computer literate, but I get on it and I work in it and I read a lot on the computer, but he doesn't at all. And he's a smart fella, and he reads books a lot. But things are moving so quickly, and it's like the man, as intelligent as he is, as well read as he is, he's got a nice education, works hard, but he just can't keep up with it. He's on the outside looking in. But yes, so it's the internet and people who know where to go and find out what's going on. And there's so many intelligent, well-spoken or good writing people. I think of Casey, one of the foremost, and Stansbury, people who I look to. And then there are other URLs one can go to and find out really good information about what's going on. And if you're not into that, if you haven't looked around, and if anybody wants to contact me, you have my bio there. I'm happy to give them some URLs that they can really find out what the really good, intelligent people are analysts and very successful people have to say about the way our Western civilization is heading.
Yeah, I did put your email address on the bio on the main page. So if people are interested in emailing you, you can email them and you'll toss them some good stuff.
Yeah, right. And then they can, not have to listen to me, but they can go find out for themselves, for the good scholarly people, what they have to say.
So
very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's another thing, too. We were talking about this because I'm at the fair. I have two booths today at the convention center, one for the Urban Farm Project, and then I have another one for Consciousness of Economics. But we were having a lot of conversations today just about every person I talked to had a different, like, they all kind of generally know about what's going on. I call them the underground thinker people, kind of, because they have different thinking than the people above ground. So it's interesting because there's so many different things going on. Like if you like the sky, then you could get into studying what's going on with the chemtrails. And then there's the food, you know, and get in there and fight Monsanto's, right? And then, right, you know, politics, the getting some new elected officials in your cities and states and in your government, your federal government. So, and there's so many different, you know, avenues that, at this point in time, like so many people, you could find the avenue you like and hook up on the internet with all kinds of amazing people or groups in your community, you know, have discussion groups as well, I think is a really great thing. I'd like to have a discussion group where I could go like once a month and everybody discuss stuff that they've been learning or topics that have been coming up or, you know, things like that. It would be great.
Yeah, most of us, I suspect all of us, Americans, we're in a period of, the sociologist Durkheim called it anomie. I believe that's the term he used. It's been years since I was in college and learned about that term. But we just get so that we're just tired of everything. We're just sad about everything, about all the problems all around us. And here's a nice buzzword. Maybe you've heard it before. It's called, what is it, normalcy bias. Have you ever heard that buzzword, normalcy bias?
No. Maybe.
Normalcy bias. In other words, we want to go toward what's normal, what we're used to, the life we're used to living, the life that's advertised
right
on the TV and in the commercials. We yep. want it. We want that. We want the life that our parents had for us. Well, to think about anything being changed is a very difficult thing. It's very saddening. And this is what Durkheim called anomie. Many of us are in that. But there is another side. And when one starts grappling with these issues, these tremendous issues that we're facing today, there is comfort. There is camaraderie, companionship with other intelligent people who, difficult as it is, are they're going to face the truth. They're going to face it. They have to face it. And yes, it's difficult, but there is another side. You come out on the other side, and then you can get it together and work with people, just like you're suggesting, that are intelligent and that do see what's going on. As bad as the truth is, still we can handle it.
So was there like a, you know, I always get the feeling when I'm talking to you, because you have these two, I mean, you've always been like, you know, really just plowing through, you know, your life and everything. Like when you needed to man a shovel, you stepped up and manned a shovel. But there's like this point in time where I talked to you where it's like there was like a turning point. And I don't really know where that turning point was. There was this past life, and then all of a sudden recently, you know, maybe within the last 10 years, you just like something snapped in you, like snapped back on. And you just really, you know, seemed like you really got involved with a lot of the information that's coming out now and also changed your whole political status. So was there like a point time where there was just like a really big shift for you?
Yeah, I did speak to it. Up until Bush sent those troops to Iraq, I was more involved with my own personal problems. The fact that I'm getting older and, you know, I'm a little overweight and, you know, I had my mortgage payment to pay and I was raising a young son and his difficulties. But then when he sent those troops off, and I just couldn't believe that he's getting us into another war, I had to rethink it, and it was very painful for me. Painful.
What was it about?
I have to come to grips with this, our wonderful, wonderful country, and we're being led by incompetence. They're incompetence. So I had to go to work and I had to study. And the first book I read was by a friend of mine. He recommended it to me, a friend of mine named Bill, and Creature from Jekyll Island. And then I began to open my eyes, and now I've started to study a lot more. So actually, in many ways, I'm just a kid.
Yeah, no,
with politics.
There's a point, there's like, and so I'm just asking you this, I'm just digging a little, because because I don't really know much about the military. You know, my dad was in the military, but I, as an American citizen, yeah, I was upset about troops being sent over to Iraq, but I have no idea about any of that. And so I'm trying to figure out what was that exactly? Was that from some kind of military history within you, or some kind of, I'm not really sure. It might be some kind of education that you had in the past.
I'll see if I can help. We can figure it out together here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the military, I was in before Vietnam. In fact, as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, we were off the coast of Laos. This is a couple of years before Vietnam. And we were ready to go into Laos. War drums were beating. We were ready to go in. But we ended up not going in. And it was until I got out of the military and started working, then went back to the university, went to the university, that we went into Vietnam with the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which is a put-up affair. One should study that. At that time, I was on the international desk at University of San Francisco State, and we all knew that the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was a put-up affair. But now it's been researched, and books and articles have been written about it, and pretty much everyone knows that it was what's called a false flag.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went through the agony of Vietnam and all those years and all those guys getting killed. And in such short order after that, we again sent our troops into Iraq, a country that wasn't a threat. And as it turned out, they didn't have any WMD, weapons of mass destruction. But even if they did, they still weren't a threat to us. So, understanding
why is your view that Iraq wasn't a threat to us? I just want other people to be able to hear this. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. You're saying you want other people to hear it?
Well, I just want you to tell.
Oh, okay, my perspective. Sure.
Yeah, why Iraq?
Yeah, wasn't a threat. And now we see the president. We've gone into Libya on executive order. Executive order. Where in the Constitution does it say we can go to war on executive order? There's nowhere it says that. And now we're on the verge of going into Iran, and it's not ending. It's not ending. This guy's doing what he wants to do. Executive order. You know, there is an article. I just came up this morning. I can refer you and your readers to it here. It's in my notes. Let me find it someplace. It's about, let's see, I'm going to think for a minute. Hard to think when I'm talking to you.
I know.
Oh, here it is. Okay, good. Okay, it just came out this morning. It's in the Huffington Post. This is online. This is an online newspaper. Huffington Post, Huffington Post, POST. And it's an article printed today. And the title of that article, and Huffington Post is pretty widely read. It's very intelligent, very clear, very well-researched articles that they adhere to professional journalism, where, in other words, if you put an article out there, you better have done your homework on it to make sure it's not a phony article.
Right.
Okay, and so they write very clearly. And the title of this article is, and I quote, "Martial Law by Executive Order." Martial Law by Executive Order. This article came out this morning. It may be something you and your listeners want to check out. And
yeah.
It's very succinct. It's short and well written, and it gives an idea of just how these executive orders are adding up. And the bottom line is the encapsulation of the article is that we are actually right now, all of us American citizens, are under a state of martial law.
Yeah, since I think January, well, New Year.
Yeah, New Year's morning, Obama signed the NDAA into law, which had that article in it that obviated our longstanding principle of posse comitatus.
And I'd heard with that law, and I haven't really had time to sit down and research this myself, but I heard that this law had three stages, and that it had been actually implemented early on in the Bush administration, the first part of it. And so the last part, Obama signed in. So there had been two parts of it that they've already been working through. Then he just signed the last part of it on New Year's morning of 2012.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You got it.
So we're going to go back to this moment in time. So you were outraged because you knew that these wars were, what did you call them, put-ups?
False flag.
False flag wars.
False flag. That means that they're created. The reasons to go to war are created. And this is common in history. And it's also common in our history. The reasons to go to war are created so we can go to war and forget about our economy or forget about our problems and go to war and concentrate on the enemy without, the outside enemy. They're called false flags.
So was there a point in time there must have been some point in time where Bush sent the military into Iraq and it was like some kind of perfect timing moment for you where everything kind of came together, right?
That's right, yeah. And it broke my spirit. I could see it coming. You can read the dispatches, you can read the news, and you can see it coming. It was inevitable. And that these guys, these neocons, you know, neoconservatives, and the whole power structure in the government and in finance, they were going to go to war. There was no way to stop them. They were just tailoring the dialogue so they could spoon feed it to the American public,
right,
and get them ready for it.
Yeah.
But the decision was made, you know, 6, 8 months, a year before, or even longer.
Even like 10 years before. Yeah.
In fact, there are reports that I've read by competent people that actually the whole Middle East policy was created in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
What we were going to do with the Middle East.
Yeah, I've read that too. So.
And I can't really call. I hesitate to say that because I can't give you a chapter and verse where that is. But it's their State Department memos written by people in the administration.
Okay, so with a few couple minutes left of the show, is there anything that you would really like to convey, like in a very short period of time here to anyone who would be listening to this, like something that you think is really important and valuable?
Well, I would say read the book, get started on a book. On that book, I can help you with a few, if you want to email me, with a few URLs of very intelligent people, good writers, with a clear point of view. And, of course, I have my own desires. I'd like to create a business that, after the social unrest, the big thrust of social unrest occurs, that I can kind of come out from underneath the woodwork and create a nice business to supply people with nutritious food. But that's about it. And I work here by myself, and I have some nice friends, and we discuss these things. And I'm willing to discuss with anybody that is interested like that.
All right. Well, hopefully you can give us a report later on in the future about Ron Paul.
Bridget, I can barely hear you now.
Oh, maybe in the future you can give us a heads up about what happens at the going down to be a delegate. That would be great to hear from you. But okay. I'm going to we're getting ready to finish the show. So I'm going to let you go, and you can go ahead and hang up. And I'll go ahead and finish, and then I'll be talking to you in person in the near future.
Thanks for having me on, Bridget.
Thanks, Gene. Bye. Thanks so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.